731 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your New Comics Wednesday episode for February 20th, 2019. We'll talk about a few of the books that are coming out today. A lot of great books coming out again this week. And, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. We really are in a golden age of comics and stories. And as I say that, you know, it kind of strikes me. I've said that before. I've said it to a lot of different people. I've said it on the podcast. I've said it to publishers, other creators, and people seem to agree with me. But at the same time, you know, I'm always saying it as a positive thing because, you know, my philosophy is there's a comic story out there for everybody, and there's never been more comic stories than there are now, and so many great ones. And so I really do feel like, yeah, can turn anyone into a comic reader. We just have to match them up with the right story, right? The story that they're going to really dig, and it's going to make them fall in love with the medium, and it'll be a gateway and open up their eyes to the possibilities of all these great stories that are out there. But at the same time, you can look at it as sort of a negative too, because retailers are being squeezed left and right, man. There are so many books out, and it's hard to know what to order and how much to order. And us fans, it's like, you can't possibly read everything. You can't possibly afford to read everything. And I don't know that we're really getting enough new readers and, you know, the next generation of readers. Maybe they'll read digital. Maybe there's more people reading digitally than I realize. But it just seems like in terms of published work, printed work, the publishers are asking this dedicated fan base, which seems to be shrinking by the year, to spend more and more money to make up for the attrition, right? So if you have 10,000 readers in 2018 and you have only 8,000 readers in 2019, those 8,000 readers need to spend more per person to make up for the 2,000 people that are lost. Is that, you know, does that make sense? And that's variant covers and $7.99 books and $10.99 books. And it doesn't seem sustainable to me. And I'm not sure what's going to happen. Recently we've heard some retailers talking about some of these same kind of things about how they just can't afford to order even books to have as back issues. Like you got to get out there and get it on the day it comes out, or you may not find it. You know, they're ordering just what they need just what they know they can sell. You know, whether that's just for the people that have a pull list, or, you know, the amount they think that they're going to sell through by Friday afternoon. And it's kind of scary when you think about it. And I think part of the reason is sort of the ease of the ability to get your work out there now. It's never been easier to get your work out there in front of people. You know, whether that's publishing digitally or self-publishing or Kickstarter or whatever. But again, there's only so much money to go around. And the other part of it is the industry is sort of a victim of its own success in a way. Like it's finally cool to like comics, right? And has been for a while now. But when I was growing up, you didn't talk about it really, except with the few friends you knew that also read comics. It was, people looked down on you. They thought, what are you like? Why are you reading comics? That's for kids, you know? Like my grandfather, he used to call them funny books. I'm like, they're not funny books. There's nothing funny about Ghost Rider, you know? But, well, maybe the Nicolas Cage movies were funny in an inadvertent way. But anyway, but the point being that, but my point is, it's cool to like comics now, right? Like Avengers is making $1 billion, and there's all these comic book TV shows and all these movies, you know, whether they're Marvel or DC or independent, and all these properties that are becoming successful movies that people didn't even realize they were a comic first. And so in addition to all these great stories from comic creators, whether it's at Marvel, DC, some independent, if it's self-published stuff, if it's creators you've heard of, or creators that are just putting something out on like Webtoon, whatever it is, you have all these creators who are passionate about comics that are creating these really, really great stories. But then, due to the fact that comics is the center of pop culture right now, you have all these other people who are aspiring screenwriters or television writers, or they have this idea for a story or a movie or whatever it might be in another medium. And for whatever reason, they haven't been able to gain any traction. They haven't been able to get their property made into a movie, into a TV series, into whatever. And so what do? They say, oh, you know what? Comics are so popular right now. All these comics are being optioned by all these different studios and TV networks and streaming services and what have you. I'll make it into a comic. And then, you know, it'll get noticed, and then I'll be able to get it made into a movie. And invariably, it doesn't really work that way. In my experience, when you take something that's meant for another medium and you shift it into comics, you can tell, and it doesn't really work. And I think comic creators kind of look down on those people. A lot of them are too nice to say so, but they look down on it, and it's just they're not good for the most part. And the problem is the passion is not there. The love of the medium, the understanding of the medium is not there. And so we can argue about whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing, but what you can't argue with is the fact that adding these type of people and their hundreds of stories that they're trying to get made into whatever are adding to this glut of books that are coming out every week. So yeah, there's a lot of great stuff coming out every week, but there's also a lot of noise that comes out, and so it makes it that much harder for your book to get noticed. And whether it's a, you know, quality book or not, whether it's a niche book, whether it's by a known creator or not, again, it's just really, really hard to get noticed, to have retailers take a chance and give you some shelf space, because space is at a premium. And again, the retailer's not looking to spend money on something that is just going to sit there. They can't afford to anymore. There's too many books, the profit margins are too thin, and it makes it a challenge. So again, it's a lot of great books out this week, but I didn't really plan on talking about this episode. It's sort of just off the top of my head as I said that, you know, a lot of great books this week. Man, I say that every week, and yeah, it's a good thing, but it's also a bad thing in a way. So anyway, it's a topic for another day. I'd love to get some other people on and get their opinions on the future of the comic industry that we all know and love. Jason Inman, my buddy Jason, comes to mind. John Suntress would be another. Maybe Matt Hawkins from Top Cow, Robert Myers from Valiant. It would be an interesting conversation for sure. Anyway, let's go ahead and dive into the books for this week. The first book I'm going to talk about, speaking of books being canceled or not making it, it's Damage from DC, and I don't remember what the final issue is. I know it's been announced what the final issue will be. I just don't remember what the issue number is for that final issue. But this is issue 14 that comes out this Wednesday. It's from Aaron Lopresti and Robert Venditti. They're listed as storytellers. Inks by Matt Ryan. Colors by Hi-Fi, and letters by Tom Napolitano. And remember, these New Age of Heroes books are done in the Marvel style, so the writer and artist discuss the plot. The artist goes off and draws the issue, hands the art over to the writer, and the writer then puts in the dialogue, the scripting. So I wish Aaron Lopresti had been on this book from the beginning, because his art is absolutely stunning. This issue is Monstrous Men and Beasts, Part 1. It's Damage on Monster Island. And I was really looking forward to this when we saw at the end of last issue that Damage was going to be on Monster Island, because I knew Lopresti was going to get to cut loose. And yeah, he didn't disappoint. It's absolutely amazing. I love the action scenes in this issue. And Lopresti, again, I wish he was on the book from the beginning for a couple reasons. First of all, I think his art style is perfectly suited for Damage. You can tell how much fun he's having drawing these incredible action scenes. And the other thing is, This book has shifted artists. It's been a little bit of a revolving door for artists on this particular book. And again, like I mentioned, it's in the Marvel style. So it's Robert Venditti collaborating with the artist to find out what's the story that the artist wants to draw. What's the story that the artist wants to tell? And so when you're constantly shifting artists, it's Robert having to bring the new artist up to speed and then pivot if that artist wants to go in a bit of a different direction. So I think that's the reason that we haven't quite gotten as much characterization or understanding of who Ethan Avery is, who's the human alter ego of Damage, and who Damage himself is. It's been a good series. It's been fun. That's one thing I'll say about it that's been consistent throughout. It's been action-oriented, it's been fast-paced, and it's been a lot of fun. But I feel like if Aaron Lopresti had been on the book the whole time, or if another artist had been on the whole time, Robert may have gotten a chance to get a little further along in character development. Because one thing that's really apparent to me in this issue 14 is that Ethan Avery is very much a complex character. And I think that Rob would have been able to develop that a little bit more, and we'd have a better sense of who Ethan is if we hadn't had these kind of fits and starts. And I think it did Damage and Ethan Avery a little bit of a disservice in terms of characterization by having a different artist jump on and off the book, especially because I would love to see more of this version of Damage, whether it's Robert or somebody else picking him up. But the thing is, if it's another writer picking up this character to use, my worry is that because there isn't a real firmly established characterization for Damage and Ethan, that whatever writer uses him, they're just going to use him as a plot device in service to their story, and his behavior or his personality will just be whatever suits that writer, rather than, well, yeah, we know how he acts. Like, everybody knows to some extent how Superman acts, how Batman acts, how Barry Allen, Flash acts, and Wally West, because again, we have, you know, hundreds of stories of these characters. It's been established over a long period of time. With Damage, we haven't gotten that. And so again, I think we'd be a little further down the path, and this issue really shows that there's a lot of depth there and a lot of layers to Ethan that Robert Venditti probably wanted to explore. And I know from having talked to Rob over the years, and you've probably even heard it on this podcast when he talks about Green Lantern or Hawkman, how he's very much a long-term planner in terms of story. He likes plans things out in like arcs of like 25. And so I think if we'd gotten at least 25 issues of Damage, we may have gotten a more firm understanding of who Ethan Avery was. So it's a little bit of a disappointment that it's ending. It's been a lot of fun. And I'm sure none of these issues are terribly expensive. So if you want to go back and pick them up, I do really recommend it. And, you know, Damage is supposed to be like one of the most powerful, one of the strongest characters in the DCU. And I love that idea that I think Superman said something along the lines like he'd never been hit that hard when Damage punched him. I just love that idea of Damage being just, you know, for an hour at a time, Ethan Avery is like the strongest being in the DC universe. That's just a great, great thing to explore. The other thing in this issue is we see the return of a character from the late Silver Age. I don't want to spoil who it is, but it was somebody I wasn't expecting to see that was like, oh, he's in this. That's great. That's really cool. And again, I just wish there were more Damage issues forthcoming. I mean, you could spend 6-8 issues on Monster Island easily and tell some really fun stories, but I don't think we're going to get that, unfortunately. So I do enjoy it. Love the book. I'm sorry to see it ending. And do yourself a favor, check it out, if only for the incredibly fun fights that Aaron Lopresti gets to draw in this issue with Damage fighting against giant monsters on Monster Island. All right, up next, I'm going to talk about Aquaman number 45. It's from writer Kelly Sue DeConnick, pencils by Robson Rocha, inks by Daniel Enriquez, colors by Sunny Gao, and letters by Clayton Cowles. So this is Unspoken Water, part 3 of 5, and I'm really struck by the deliberate pace that Kelly Sue DeConnick is taking with Aquaman, and I'm enjoying it. We're halfway through, and I wonder if at the end of her first arc, if Aquaman is going to regain his memory and be returned back to the DC proper, or is the mystery going to continue? I'm anxious for Aquaman to get back to the regular DC universe, but not because I'm not enjoying what's going on and the mythos and the world building that Kelly Sue is doing. I really am enjoying it, but I'm enjoying it so much that I'm so interested in seeing what Kelly Sue does with Aquaman once she establishes this sort of new status quo for him. We know from Kelly Sue's interviews and when I was at one of the DC panels at New York Comic Con last year, she was talking about how the fish out of the water story has been kind of done to death with Aquaman, and she wanted to move past that. You know, the idea of here's this guy who's part human and part Atlantean, and he's not really doesn't feel comfortable on land or the sea. He's not accepted by the surface or the Underwater Kingdom because they say, oh, you belong on the surface. You belong, you know, he's a half breed. Again, that story's been done to death. So what is the new status quo? What is the new story that Kelly Sue can tell? I don't know how much input she had into the Drowned Earth storyline that Scott Snyder and James Tynan told in the pages of Justice League, but I loved that story. It was great how, for the first time ever, Aquaman is really, in my mind, seen as kind of a symbol of hope. So incorporating that and then seeing who Aquaman is with this kind of new mythos and new status quo that Kelly Sue is introducing, I'm excited to see how that all plays out. How is this sort of new take on Aquaman? How does he interact with the Justice League? How does he interact with the surface world? What's going to be different? And really looking forward to seeing how that all plays out. Because again, I love the world building. I love the tone and the feel of the story that Kelly Sue is bringing to it. So again, I'm not sure if it can all be wrapped up in a couple more issues. I'm thinking not, just because, again, it is somewhat of a deliberate pace. But the other thing about it is that I feel like each of these issues, it's been jam-packed with story. Like there was even a point in this issue where I thought, is this double-sized? Because I feel like I'm getting a lot here, a lot of characterization, a lot of story. And I mean, I probably didn't think it was double-sized, but was it a couple extra pages here or there? And it's a real credit to Kelly Sue and the whole creative team, really, on the story structure and the way everything was set up. Because the thing about it is Robson Rocha really puts a lot of big panels and a lot of splash pages in this issue. And there are quite a few text boxes. I mean, it doesn't feel like overwhelming. It doesn't feel like it's a dense read, but it just feels substantial. And that's really impressive, again, considering how many splash pages and really large panels are in the book. The color palette's a little muted, and it has been sort of the entire time, which suits the tone and the mood of the story that Kelly Sue is telling. But Robson Rocha and Daniel Enriquez do an incredible job with the art. Again, a lot of splash pages, and the really impactful images. They feel very mythic and very godlike. And so really enjoying what's going on here. So not sure what comes next for Aquaman. I imagine probably at least one more arc in this unspoken water territory, or perhaps Aquaman will move on from this, but I just don't see him coming back to the regular DCU after only this one arc. But I'll tell you what, I really did enjoy seeing Aquaman as a symbol of hope. In that Justice League Drowned Earth storyline, kind of the Blue Lantern Aquaman, and that is a story that would be absolutely incredible to tell, especially if we could get Brad Walker to draw it, because I really fell in love with Brad's art on Green Lantern New Guardians, and then he did a few other things. I think he did an issue of Action Comics, at least one, But then on Rebirth, he was on Aquaman, and he did a lot of the covers, was supposed to do interiors. He didn't do a lot of interiors, and he kind of did it to himself when he designed Aquaman's Rebirth costume. He drew a lot. The orange shirt was, instead of scales, it was a bunch of like sea pebbles. And he made it so intricate and detailed that then it took him forever to draw it. And so he didn't have time to do as many interiors as he would have liked. But an Aquaman story with Aquaman in space as a Blue Lantern with Brad Walker drawing it. Yeah, in, definitely in. I would eat that up. That would be absolutely incredible. I don't know if it even makes a whole lot of sense, you know, a water-based superhuman in space, but oh, man, Brad wouldn't have to worry about drawing all those pebbles because you just put him in a Blue Lantern costume. But that would just be really cool. I mean, he could go to like planets that are aquatic. There's no reason why he couldn't. It would be really, really cool. But anyway, I have absolutely no idea if Kelly Sue has that plan. Probably not. I wouldn't necessarily think so. But I am very curious how much input she had into the Drowned Earth storyline, or I mean, it led directly into this. You know, Aquaman disappears at the end of that storyline after saving the world. So you know that James and Scott and Kelly Sue had to talk on some level, because James and Scott had Aquaman disappear. So, again, I don't know how much input she had into it, but I'm curious to see what happens when Aquaman returns to the DC Universe proper. I'm digging what Kelly Sue's doing. I'm glad she's over at DC now. I loved a lot of her Marvel work. I think she did a great job on Captain Marvel. And yeah, I'd love to see her do some other work. Like a Batman story from her would be interesting. I wouldn't mind seeing her do some Wonder Woman work. Seeing her on a team book would be cool. Like Titans maybe would be something I'd be interested in seeing her do. So yeah, there's a lot of characters. I wonder what she'd do with Legion of Superheroes. That would be another one that would be pretty interesting. Or Lois Lane. We know there's a Lois Lane book coming up soon. I imagine she'd write a pretty good Lois Lane story. And you know, the other thing that would be interesting, and I don't know that Kelly Sue's ever done this, but I don't know that she's ever been in charge of a big event, like the showrunner for a big event. So I'd be curious to see what she'd do if she were given the reins to some sort of you know, company-wide crossover event kind of situation. So, yeah, love what she's doing here. And again, very curious to see where it goes from here, because I love the voice she's giving Aquaman, and I'm just super curious to see, okay, once he regains his memories, will he sound more like the guy we know, or will he evolve past that? What about the whole Hope thing? Can we get that Blue Lantern Aquaman in space story? Somebody? Anybody? Anyway, let's move on. Aquaman 45 is a great book, and two more issues to go in that first arc. Curious to see how it ends. All right, up next we have Batman number 65 from writer Joshua Williamson. The art is by Guillaume March. We have colors by Tameyu More, letters by Steve Wands. And this is part three of the Price storyline, which is crossing over between Batman and Flash. And for those that aren't aware, Tom King, I think, was going to co-write this with Joshua Williamson. But then he had a super secret TV project, as he called it. And he ended up handing over the reins to Joshua Williamson to handle it solo. I'm sure they had talked about the story somewhat, but Josh is handling all four issues. So we've seen the return of Gotham Girl. We saw in Flash 64 a silhouette of the person that was calling the shots, sort of behind the scenes, sort of instigating this these attacks by Gotham Girl on Flash and Batman, and it very much looked to be Bane. I mean, it looked like Bane in silhouette. He had a red glowing eye, so I'm pretty sure it's Bane. You know, we know that Gotham Girl's been using Venom to sort of create these superpowered doppelgangers of her brother, so to speak. So again, it feels very Bane-ish. But the other thing that it feels is it feels very despondent in a way. It's like a very down story. It feels very nihilistic. Gotham Girl knows that when she uses her power, she's hastening her own death, and she doesn't care. And you know, saw the destruction of the Flash Museum. You have the dynamic of Flash and Batman. A lot that's not said there about the death of Wally in the Heroes in Crisis story at Sanctuary. And it's a very, I don't want to say a negative story, but it's very melancholy in a way. And it feels like it suits sort of the mood that Batman has been in ever since Batman 50, when Catwoman left him there. He's not happy. He is a very sad individual these days. And this is a very sad story in a way. And so I like the tone and the feel that Joshua Williamson is bringing to it, especially considering half of the story is in Flash issues, which the Flash is typically, you know, as much danger as Barry's been in lately, him and Iris on the Force Quest, it always has felt like there's at least a spark of hope or a light at the end of the tunnel. And now all of a sudden, this story, it's swung the other way and gotten really, really dark. So again, it suits the mood Batman's in. It suits the mood Flash is starting to be in, based on the fact that he's lost Wally. He just learned about it. Of course, he's going to be sad. And so the tone and the mood are pitch perfect. Plus, the story in itself is interesting. But I will say I'm not a big fan of Gotham Girl. I thought Gotham himself was an interesting character. His sister less so. And so if this kind of resolves them and takes them off the table completely, like we don't have to see them anymore, I'm fine with that. The other thing that's interesting is to think about, so how far in advance does Tom King plan, right? Did he have an idea when he was writing those very first Rebirth issues of Batman that Gotham Girl would show back up around issue 60 or 65 of Batman, and he would be telling a story, well, Joshua Williamson actually would be telling a story about Bane and Gotham Girl and trying to revive her brother and everything. It's like, man, did he really? I mean, that was like 2 years ago. So it wouldn't surprise me if Tom has done that. If he had his, I'm sure he probably had his entire Batman run all planned out. But man, that's like next level planning for sure. The other thing I'll say about the issue, the art by Guillaume March suits the tone very well. Guillaume's art's different to me than it usually looks. And I think I commented on that before when I saw him do a Batman issue. I first saw his work on the New 52 Catwoman issues, and there his art was like very fine lines, very detailed, you know, a little almost Adam Hughes-ish, or maybe Art Germ, where, you know, very beautiful women, voluptuous. Here it's much more visceral and still pretty detailed. His line work, the lines look a little heavier than I remember seeing them in the past, but I cannot fault his storytelling. And I think the thing that he's best at, what I love about his art the most, are his layouts within the panels, like the way he moves the camera around, the angles he chooses to illustrate different characters at. It's really, really good. He moves the camera around a lot in the panels, and it's really, really spectacular. I mean, there are some great, great panels in here. There's especially one page where the panels are basically sound effects, where Flash gets pretty thrashed, which is really, really brutal. So one issue to go on this Price story. And again, I hope it resolves the whole Gotham Girl story once and for all, and we don't necessarily have to see those characters show back up again. They're not interesting to me at all. So All right, up next we have Justice League number 18, which is actually a Legion of Doom issue. All the Legion of Doom issues have been written by James Tynan. The art in this issue is by Pasquale Ferri. We have colors by Hi-Fi and letters by Tom Napolitano. This is basically a Lex Luthor Brainiac team up, and it has an incredible regular cover by Francis Manapul, which is just amazing. I love the way Brainiac looks on this cover, the lighting and effects that Francis put in the cover are spectacular. It's so good. It's definitely up there as one of my favorite covers of the year so far. So yeah, as I said, Brainiac, Luthor team up, get a little bit more information about the totality. We get a little bit more history of Vandal Savage, a little bit more history of Lionel Luthor. And I don't know if I'd call it retconning. It's certainly changing what we've known or what we thought we knew about these characters, but it feels additive and it makes sense the way Tynan is writing it. And the art by Pasquale Ferri is great. So overall, I thought this was a really cool issue, a little bit of a throwback feel. You know, Luthor Brainiac team up is from back in the Silver Age. These guys would team up, and they don't always have the best relationship. They've teamed up over the years, and it hasn't always worked out too well for Brainiac. Luthor usually ends up with the upper hand. Thinking about some of those Triangle era Brainiac stories when Brainiac had possessed the mind of Milton Fine, who was sort of a circus performer, you know, mentalist, what have you. And Luthor kind of got the drop on him and took advantage for sure. And so seeing this version of Brainiac and Luthor team up is interesting. It brings back some of the classic feel of the Bronze Age. So, been digging Justice League since Scott and James and Joshua Williamson relaunched their three Justice League titles, and this one is a worthy chapter in the story, and I can't wait to see when things finally come to a head with Perpetua and the Totality and the Legion of Doom. All right, up next we have Middle West, issue number 4, from writer Scotty Young. The art is by Jorge Corona. Colors are by Jean-Francois Bellu. Letters by Nate Picos of Blambot. There is a giant robot on the cover of this issue. There's a giant robot in the issue. He works at a carnival or a fair, and he repairs the rides along with his what looks to be teenage creator. And I got very much sort of a Ratchet and Clank sort of feel. You know, this automaton, this cool looking robot, and it suits sort of the Wizard of Oz, Land of Oz type feel that Scotty Young has been given the story. I mentioned that previously, how much this really feels like a story that could exist in Frank Elbaum's Oz. And so we didn't get a whole lot of forward momentum in terms of characterization or in terms of what's going to happen next in the story. What's going to happen with Abel? Is his father going to find? His father doesn't even show up in this issue. What powers Abel might possess. It's the power thing is touched on briefly, but really I feel like this issue was a lot of establishing the world and introducing maybe some new supporting characters. Because as I said, that robot Wrench was really cool looking. His teenage creator, Bobby, I think her name was. She was interesting. And then the head of the fair, or carnival, Maggie, I imagine we're going to see more of her as well. When you think about it, it makes sense to sort of match up or have Abel join up with a traveling Circus or Traveling Carnival. It's sort of a classic storytelling device, right? To have this kid who's a runaway hook up with these nomads, basically, who travel around from place to place. So it was a fun issue. Again, absolutely love the robot, and curious to start getting a few more answers about this world, about what exactly is up with Abel, what's up with his father, what are the powers he has, and see that wizard show back up. I can't remember what the name of that wizard was, who basically instructed Abel to go out and find this fortune teller to get some information and find out what his powers are, what this tattoo or scar or birthmark or whatever it is that's on Abel's neck, what exactly is going on with that as well. Jeb, that's the name of the guy. So if you haven't checked out Middle West, I think it's the first issue's on like the fourth or fifth printing now. People are discovering it late and jumping on, so you can easily be one of those people. I do recommend picking it up. It is a really fun book. The art by Jorge Corona. I feel like he's starting to get comfortable in this world and with these characters, because his art's starting to have a little bit more of a flow to it. And his style really suits the story that's being told as well. It's a little cartoony. It's a little exaggerated. But his art is very emotive and pretty detailed as well. So, and I love the fact that he doesn't, it's not photorealistic or proper anatomy by any stretch of the imagination, but he still manages to put a lot of emotion in the faces of his characters, which is great. Up to and including that robot wrench, which is just really, really cool looking. All right, up next we have Naomi number 2 from writers Brian Michael Bendis and David F. Walker. Art by Jamal Campbell, letters by Carlos M. Mangual. So first of all, props to Jamal Campbell for handling all the art, including the color work. I think I mentioned this when I talked about issue 1. I don't know if I ever read anything that had Jamal Campbell art in it. But man, this guy, he's going to be a superstar. I know DC wants to keep Bendis happy, and I suppose it depends on how well Naomi sells if they keep Campbell on this book, but I can't imagine them not putting Campbell on a really high profile book sooner than later. In a way, he reminds me of Jason Fabok, and I don't mean that necessarily in terms of art style, although his art is pretty detailed and so is Jason's, but their styles are very very different. But I feel like Jason came on the scene, did a few issues of Detective, then was on Batman Eternal, and then was like Jeff Johns on Justice League, really high profile book, and now doing the Three Jokers, and pretty much can do any book he wants to do. He's that popular and that well liked, and DC knows that they have something special in him. I think I could easily see Jamal Campbell's career taking the same sort of path. Whether or not he chooses to keep working with Brian Michael Bendis, that might be the case, but I would think they'd put him on a more higher profile book than this Naomi book, whether that's a different Wonder Comics title, whether that's putting him on one of the Superman titles. I'd love to see Jamal do Action Comics. That would be amazing. But the art is just stunningly good in this issue. I love the look that he gives Naomi. I love the color work, the detail, that he makes really smart choices in terms of transitions from panel to panel. I mean, it's just, it is so, so good. Yeah, it's stunningly good. He could be quickly becoming one of my favorite artists after only 2 issues. So that's really saying something. The art is just spectacular. As far as the story, very intrigued by what Bendis and Walker are doing. I love the voice and the curiosity they've given to Naomi. Clearly, there's more than meets the eye here. She senses it. We as the readers sense it. Apparently, the only people that don't sense it are her parents, her adoptive parents, and they could be pretending not to know more than they're letting on because they are trying to protect Naomi, or perhaps they're trying to keep something from her for more nefarious reasons. Just not sure. One of the most interesting things that I saw, and I went back and looked for it later and I couldn't find it, but somebody, I think it might have been on Twitter, mentioned the fact that maybe Naomi and her friends that we saw in the first issue, maybe these are all Legion of Superheroes characters. Maybe the Legion has been brought back in time and their memories erased and they don't realize that they are who they are. That's an incredible idea. That would be amazing if that's how this turns out. That would be a really, really cool idea. And it turns out DC brought Legion of Superheroes back, but they did it stealth. And so I couldn't help but read this second issue with that idea in my head and start trying to decide, so who would Naomi be? Who would these other characters be? So, I don't know. The big guy that we saw, the car mechanic, auto mechanic that we saw last issue, D. I'm like, well, he could be Block, but then wouldn't they be calling him B instead of D? Yeah, I'm not sure, but what I do know is we get a blurb at the end of issue 2 here that says, next, the secret history of the DC Universe. So clearly we're going to find out something, and I can't wait to find out, because this is a book where I've got to read it the second I get my hands on it. It's that good. This is probably my favorite Brian Michael Bendis written thing ever. It's that good, and it completely took me by surprise. I'm glad I tried out issue 1. This is a comic for anybody who loves stories, really. Anybody who loves science fiction or superheroes. I think that Naomi's going to be something special, and it's going to be one of those titles where people are like, man, I wish I had a first issue. I wish I had a second issue, because I slept on it and I didn't find out until, you know, issue 4 or 5 how good it was, and I wasn't able to pick up those early issues. So do yourself a favor. Get out there, pick up issue 2 this week. Hopefully your shop will have an issue 1 still in stock as well, so you can get caught up. Up next, we have a Wildstorm issue number 20 from Warren Ellis, art by John Davis Hunt, colors by Steve Bucciolato, letters by Simon Boland. I've talked tons about how incredible the Wildstorm story is. Talked about the fact that this is Warren Ellis's spin on these characters and this universe. It's not really meant to resemble the Jim Lee Wildstorm universe. This is a complete reimagining. I'm enjoying it. I wasn't a big Wildstorm reader back in the day, so for me, the changes don't really bother me. I know some hardcore Wildstorm fans have had some issues with it, but I'm just enjoying the story for what it is. And the reason I wanted to mention issue 20 is because we get tons of Midnighter and Apollo scenes. That's pretty much all this issue is. And it's really, really cool to see the Apollo or the Midnighter and Apollo in action. They really do a number on their foes. And the John Davis Hunt art, spectacular as always, super detailed. I love the feel and the tone and the mood that Steve Bucciolato brings to the book with his color work. That color work coupled with John Davis Hunt's artwork gives this book like a very separate and distinct feel. And I think I mentioned in the past that I hope Davis Hunt does every single issue, because I don't know that another artist could capture that tone and feel the way that Davis Hunt does. And it would be a real shame if, when this thing comes out in a collected edition, if there was another artist in there, it would I think really throw off the flow of the story. So I'm glad John Davis Hunt has been able to do all the issues. So again, I'm really enjoying it. I love the sort of Elseworlds feel that the story has, and it's going to be one of those that I'm going to have to go back and reread once all the issues are out, probably in one or two sittings, just to have a better understanding of the story, because there's so much to unpack here. And despite the fact I know some hardcore Wildstorm fans aren't really digging it, I really think if you're a really hardcore Wildstorm fan, you should check it out, because I think you can get even more out of it than somebody like me does, because I'm not really that familiar with all these characters. And I understand that Warren Ellis is sort of changing these characters around, but if you have knowledge of what they were like before, I feel like you can pick up on some of the subtle clues and some of the subtle things that Ellis is doing when he's reimagining these characters. So again, I think Wildstorm's a very underrated title. It's another one I don't hear a lot of people talking about, but it's a title that I certainly recommend. All right, let's see. Up next we have... Book of the Week, actually. And it's from DC Vertigo. And apologies, the review copy I got didn't have the credits listed, so I'm not sure who did the lettering. But it has Rob Sheridan, Barnaby Bagenda, and Romulo Fajardo Jr. listed in the credits on the cover. So I know Rob Sheridan wrote it. Barnaby Bagenda handled the art, I'm assuming, and Romulo Fajardo Jr. handled the colors, because he is a colorist. So again, apologies if I'm missing any creators. Certainly I know I'm missing the letterer, but if there's anybody else beyond that, apologies. I'll hopefully have that rectified next time I cover an issue of High Level, because I certainly will be covering another issue of High Level, because this book was awesome. It was so great. Such amazing world building from Rob Sheridan, and the artwork by Barnaby Bagenda was next level, no pun intended. I know Barnaby worked with Tom King on the Omega Men series from a few years back, but I feel like his art really leveled up, again, pun intended that time. But yeah, his art really is taken to the next level in this series. And I know at New York Comic Con, Rob Sheridan talked about this story being a post-apocalyptic story. So basically the story of what happens after the apocalypse, and society is starting to rebuild. And I think I read somewhere that he got the idea by listening to some kind of a commentary track on a Star Trek DVD. And the futurist was talking about the fact that in a lot of these post-apocalyptic stories, it's all about humanity sort of doing whatever they need to do to survive and pick up the pieces of civilization and start to rebuild civilization. And the futurist was saying that's not really what it would be like at all if there were a true apocalypse, because when you start to rebuild from scratch, you throw out everything from before, and you rebuild starting from that moment with whatever the values and sensibilities of that time and era are. So it could end up being something wildly different. And so we know from clues that Rob Sheridan gives in the first issue of High Level that a lot of the past has been forgotten by the people that are still living, and they're just trying to get by with what they have. And there's a lot of ideas in here, a lot of classic scientific tropes. High Level refers to this supposed escape, this supposed part of the world where things are a lot better. You know, we've seen it in what was the Matt Damon movie, Elysium, I think it was called, where Jodie Foster and her colleagues were living in the city above everybody else that was still down on the planet, and they were like the worker bees, so to speak. So we've got a little bit of that. We get introduced to a child who is prophesied to save the world. We've seen that before, certainly in things like Waterworld and other stories. And so our protagonist, our heroine, 13, is charged with taking this child to high level to save the world, so to speak. So again, these aren't 100% original ideas, but Sheridan gives a great voice to 13. He gives a twist on everything, and he introduces enough mystery and sort of conspiracies and kind of flips a few things on their head to where it makes for a very intriguing read. And what really puts it over the top is the Barnaby Bagenda art. And Romulo Fajardo Jr. on colors, also typically bright palette, but a little muted. It looks almost digitally painted. A lot of blues, a lot of reds, and just an incredible book to look at. But also the scripting by Sheridan, I have to give him props for that too, because he does something interesting with the dialogue to where you do feel like this is, you know, it's not the world outside our window right now. This is a different world, a different place. So again, it's my book of the week because I want to be sure that you guys go out there and pick it up. It's definitely worth reading. It's an incredible start to a series, and I can't wait to see what happens next. It's really incredible. I think this might be the first comic that Rob Sheridan has written. And if so, man, props to you, Rob, because you really knocked out of the park on this one. Absolutely love this first issue, and really looking forward to more. I'll probably read it a couple more times. I read it twice already. It was that good. So I love the protagonist, 13. She's tough and she's likable. And again, love the voice that Sheridan gives her. So I hope you guys all check out High Level and like it as much as I did. All right, let me give a rundown on some of the other books that are coming out today. From Aftershock Comics, we have Hot Lunch Special number 5, which wraps up that series. We have a Relay number 4, and we have Stronghold number 1. And I hope you guys all enjoyed the interview I had with Phil Hester on the Monday's Aftershock episode about Stronghold. Its first issue was really, really strong, so I hope you all picked it up. Over at Dark Horse, we have Anthem number 1. Which is a prequel to BioWare's upcoming game. So very much science fiction oriented title. At DC, I mentioned a lot of these books already, but I do want to mention that Catwoman number 8 comes out today, as well as Lucifer number 5, Nightwing number 57, which I almost talked about, but I'm behind on Nightwing. And I did check out issue 57, though, because Zach Kaplan is co-writing the series, and I hope he's going to be taking it over solo really soon from Scott Lobdell, because as listeners know, I'm a huge Zach Kaplan fan, and hopefully we'll have Zach on the show soon. He reached out to me recently and was like, yeah, we need to talk soon. So it's just been so busy. It's been tough to find time, but I did enjoy Nightwing 57. It just... And I was able to understand or pick up what's been going on, even though I'm like 20 issues behind. So if you're looking for a good jumping on point, I think that would serve you well. From Image, we have Bitterroot number 4 and Sharky the Bounty Hunter number 1, which I believe is a Mark Millar story with art by Simone Bianchi. And I remember hearing some news about Sharky the Bounty Hunter, but I'm just not sure what it was. I'm not a huge Mark Miller fan, so I'm not sure. Didn't really pay that much attention. Over at Marvel, the Age of X-Man continues with another new number one, this time the Amazing Nightcrawler number one. We also have Guardians of the Galaxy number two from Donny Cates. Miles Morales Spider-Man number three from Saladin Ahmed. And the final issue of Return of Wolverine from Charles Soule. Number five is out. Also, the Uncanny X-Men number 12, Matthew Rosenberg solo on that series now, comes out today as well. Over at Valiant, X-O Manowar number 24, and the first issue of their latest event series, Incursion number one, which I do recommend you picking up. It's surprisingly intriguing story that's sort of a cross between the Dead Side part of the Valiant Universe with the Eternal Warrior part of the Valiant Universe. So again, I really did enjoy the first issue, and we had Alex Pacnadel on recently to talk about some of the ideas and what to expect from that series going forward. So I do recommend that as well. So I hope you all enjoyed the episode. I hope it gives you an idea of what to be on the lookout for when you hit up your local comic book shop today. Remember what I said about the tough times for the retailers these days, and the best thing you can do is pre-order your books, whether that's from somewhere online or having a pull list or just letting your retailers know what you're interested in. Any communication, any information you give them only helps them make better decisions when it comes to ordering their books. So always encourage you to be very mindful of letting your retailer know what books you're interested in. So I think that's going to do it. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.